Listening to the Arctic comes to you from the National Science Foundation, supporting early stage research in all fields of science and engineering, from the Earth's poles to black holes.
When you're a scientist in the Arctic in the winter, the ice is your life. You work on the ice. You live there.
The common technique that we use is to fly out, land on the ice, and establish a small camp.
Jamie Morrison is a polar oceanographer. He studies ice-covered oceans.
And then this camp drifts along with the sea ice over the ocean.
One late afternoon in 2013, his team flew out to one of those places. They call them ice camps. Middle of the Arctic Ocean, near the North Pole. It was run by some Russians.
We landed and were shown to our tent and went to bed.
4 a.m, they bolt awake.
The door burst open, and one of the Russian operators loudly informed us that the ice camp is breaking up.
They throw on their clothes and rush outside.
And sure enough, we were surrounded by 28 degree Fahrenheit, 4,000 meter deep water.
And the thing is, it's not just one crack.
It was as if every tent or every small group of tents had its own circle of water around it. So we were like a bunch of rafts drifting around in the Arctic Ocean. I'd had a little experience with camp breakups before, and I knew that usually, at least before, I'd always survived, so I guess that gave me a little comfort. But I have to say, this was a scarier situation than I'd ever seen before.
Aside from any immediate fear, there was a deeper, more long-lasting concern, because it occurred to them that this kind of thing just didn't used to happen.
Back a few years ago, there was plenty of what they call multi-year ice.
That's ice that's lasted through more than one summer, getting thicker and thicker. It might be 13 feet thick. That's what you'd camp on.
When we later flew around, you could see that all the multi-year ice was gone.
And this is not just a problem for Jamie Morrison. This is something that's going on all over the Arctic.
The warm period we're entering now is unlike anything we've seen since modern humans evolved.
We're seeing a 40% loss of ice now compared to what we had more than a decade ago.
It's not just sea ice that is diminishing. Land ice, glaciers, ice sheets are rapidly diminishing as well.
People never thought it would happen, and it has.
And if you've heard the stories or seen pictures maybe of stranded polar bears and you think, that's sad, but it's all happening so far away, think again.
These effects affect our atmosphere and affect global temperature. And so what happens in the Arctic does affect the rest of us.
If you buy things that come through global shipping, the Arctic affects you. If you eat seafood, the Arctic affects you.
The difference between the coast of Maine now and the coast of Maine 30 years ago was
the Gulf of Maine is warming right now.
I have seen changes. In my area, we've had declines. Yeah, I'm thinking about the changes. To me, it's the rate of change is different.
If lobstering was gone or fishing was gone, my community is gone.
And if you're looking for a bellwether for how our entire world is changing, the Arctic affects you.
Sea ice has shrunk by over 50% in the last few decades.
While it's certainly true that less ice means new opportunities for shipping and resource extraction, continued warming could also mean unprecedented risks, environmental, social, cultural, economic, political, and legal across the globe. Rising seawater is already taking a toll in places nowhere near the Arctic, places like southern Louisiana.
Anytime you get more than a 50 mile an hour south wind blowing for 2 days, the water's coming in.
If we get hurricanes that go on the west side of us, we get water.
Out of all of our family that live back here, 25 members lost everything.
Well, my mom, my grandma, my brother, and the house we lived on that highway right there got water completely up to the ceiling.
But water's got to go somewhere. I've been on the water all my life. And if you try to stop the water here, it's just going to go around there. It's going to get to you. Water will find this level.
And in the Arctic itself, in Alaska, Siberia, Greenland, ways of hunting, eating, and speaking that are thousands of years old are being swept away, along with the ground beneath people's feet.
maybe 10 years back. We were hitting 50, 60 below weather, wintertime. It might do that nowadays for one day. That's it.
Scientists know the rapid pace of change means we really need to get up there and understand what's happening right now. And while you probably think science knows everything there is to know about this problem, the truth is that largely we don't.
We're in a very data-poor area of the world, yet we're in part of the world that is experiencing changes very quickly.
2 to 3 times as rapidly as the rest of the globe.
Observation is super important because things are changing even as we speak.
And we're seeing combinations of species, for example, that are different from what we have seen before. We know
there wasn't any moose around our area. Now there are many, so many around today.
They're seeing incidents of more disease, things they haven't seen before in fish.
The world is changing.
And if you don't have baseline information, you don't know how they're changing.
But while the problems are serious and huge, they're not hopeless. We're at a stage with the Arctic today that's comparable to where we were at previous points of discovery. Think outer space research in the 1950s or research on electricity before Edison. Think about how far we've come. There was a time when we knew practically nothing, but now, like then, people are poised at the entrance to the new frontier.
I'm standing on an Arctic coastline on the Beaufort Sea coast.
We're on Greenland, right on the edge of the Greenland ice sheet.
We are at the Tulik Field Station, 375 miles north of Fairbanks, Alaska, and about 140 miles.
Today, there are opportunities to have a huge impact, and there is a cadre of scientists working proactively to understand and forecast this environmental change and reliably chart the future course of the Arctic.
Scientists are there studying oceanography, they're there studying atmospheric chemistry, they're there studying anthropology.
And there are scientists working to create technologies to address emerging problems.
Over on the far side, we have what we affectionately know as the cool robot. And this
we have about 200 horsepower compressor here that's going to drive the refrigerator system for the ice internal to bring the temperature.
Along with all that, there's a growing realization.
The problems are very complex. You can't just solve them, say, with a biology solution or a political science solution.
The challenges of the Arctic involve the greatest possible scope and complexity. Meeting them requires the convergence of technology, science, people, and policy. No individual scientific discipline or agency or nation can meet them alone. It's going to take multiple minds looking at things from multiple directions.
The advantage to that is that if you have a team where you're working with an engineer and a hydrologist and a sociologist and a demographer, you're able to look at the whole complex nature of problems and questions that we have right now.
You can add to that physicists and oceanographers and geologists and others from all over the world working together along with local populations to improve Arctic observation, ensure shared and open data, and strengthen the region's infrastructure. All to figure out what's going on up there, how it might change, what its impacts might be on the Arctic and the rest of the globe, and to find solutions. There are things we can do to put our arms around this problem, even if we're only just beginning to see them up close.
7.1 temperature, 103.6% DO, go down to salinity, which is 16.94 on the surface.
It's people like Ken Dunton. He's a professor at the University of Texas who spends most of his summers 3,600 miles north of home.
Chlorophyll 1.0, pH is 7.66, PE is 2.45.
Today, he's on Elson Lagoon near Point Barrow, Alaska, working as something of an underwater weather forecaster by deploying instruments that tell us the temperature, salinity, dissolved oxygen, and other things inside aquatic storehouses at the top of the world.
Mark 897 and 1505.45.
All three Inupiat villages on the Arctic coast are situated on estuarine lagoon systems. And the reason why is because these lagoon systems have an abundance of finfish, like char, cisco, broad whitefish.
In Kotzebue, most of our food comes from out there.
Ross Schaefer relies on all those fish, too. He lives in Kotzebue, Alaska, about 350 miles from where Ken works, but also on the Chukchi Sea bordering the Arctic Ocean. Ross spoke recently for a project by Farthest North Films.
The salmon, the crab, all the different cods that we get out there, the halibut, all feed off one source, and that's the plankton and the krill that are out there. Everything feeds off them. Because of ocean acidification, it will prevent hardening of shellfish species out in the ocean. So that's the scary
thing. Acidification is just one of the problems they're seeing up in that part of Alaska.
As the ice retreats further and further offshore, the waves get bigger. And as the waves get bigger, they pound the coast.
They're getting waves higher than anyone's ever seen up there. They're swamping boats and drowning people. On top of that, hunters who have spent generations out on the ice are losing their way of life. Anna Kurtula is an Alaska anthropologist.
Breathing hole seal hunting has become extremely dangerous.
The makeup of the ice has changed. You don't have the real large, good ice. It makes it harder to hunt successfully where that ice that you're going out to look for is thinner ice.
Our elders knew when to go hunting. They knew when not to. They knew the ice conditions.
C. Kurik Whiting is the former mayor of the Northwest Arctic Borough, a county in Alaska.
It has not only become more unpredictable, but it's become very different at certain times of years. So that local traditional knowledge, the uncertainty now.
It's not easy to predict the ice anymore. It's also not easy to predict the way in which the wind will blow the ice.
Alaska is not the only place touched by the challenges presented by a changing Arctic. There are also concerns about threats to economic prosperity 3,500 miles to the east.
We're trying to figure out where normal is supposed to be.
Kristen Porter lives in Cutler, Maine, just south of the Canadian border. He's president of the Maine Lobstermen's Association.
I'm from an area where all the science show that all the lobsters are going to move north. Well, I'm north, and my catch has gone down over the last 7 or 8 years every year.
And he's not alone.
There's a lot of uncertainty about the future of the marine system in the Gulf of Maine.
Robin Alden is recently retired as executive director of the Maine Center for Coastal Fisheries. Today, she says New England lobstermen are seeing increased water from melted Arctic ice, along with warmer ocean temperatures. And it has them scratching their heads. Tad Miller lives on Matinicus Island, 19 miles off the Maine coast in the Atlantic Ocean.
The younger guys kept asking me, what's going to happen next? I said, I have no idea. I've been 45 years now, and I, honest to God, did not have an idea what was going to happen after that.
We look for certain patterns and whatnot, but the patterns now vary a lot year to year.
That's John Williams, vice president of the Maine Lobstermen's Association. He lives on another island off the Maine coast. He says those patterns used to be clear. You'd find lobsters in certain places during certain times of the year. It was so regular, lobstermen would keep books listing the patterns on board their boats. Today, John says,
well, you might as well throw the book out because it's changing every year.
As of now, yields are good, but collapse is in the back of everyone's mind because if it happens, Tad Miller says, it would be a disaster.
Lobstering has always been, that's what Maine is, so you lose your identity.
In Alaska, the stakes are even higher. As anthropologist Anna Kurtula points out.
Not allowing an indigenous person, Alaska Native or Greenlander, to subsistence hunt and fish would be like not allowing a devout Catholic to take the sacrament.
Subsistence hunting, she says, reinforces the underpinnings of social cohesion. Young people go out and hunt for the first time, come back to the village.
And then you give everything away.
Losing the ability to hunt, she says, damages your ideas about giving, about sharing. The warming has also brought a more urgent concern, one that highlights the interdependence between the social and natural and the built environments in the Arctic. Those links are also changing, and the consequences will be dire.
Flood sirens in Venice, Italy today as high tides continue to swamp the historic city of canals.
Certainly, Venice stands as a warning to those that say coastal areas could disappear. Venice is probably the most ancient and certainly the most famous example of what could happen when waters start eroding.
While it's certainly the most famous, a more dramatic example might be a place 4,500 miles away.
We have one community, Kivalina, that really needs to relocate.
Kivalina is getting narrow, real narrow.
gotta move someplace.
That was Reggie Jewell, former mayor of Alaska's Northwest Arctic Borough, and Orrin Knox, who lives in Kevalina, a little town on a spit of land with 377 people in it. They also spoke to Farthest North Films. For the past several years, the permafrost that's undergirded the village for centuries has melted, and Kevalina is slipping ever closer into the Arctic Ocean.
When they first say it's global warming, the permafrost is melting, I said, I won't believe you unless I see it with my own eyes.
Joe Swan is another resident of Kivalina.
Now I know it's global warming. Permafrost is melting.
The land is disappearing at a very rapid rate.
Here's Ross Schaefer again from Kotzebue.
I think in about 10 years, many of the houses are not going to be there, or they're going to have to move them further back, because prevailing winds now are taking away what the west winds used to deposit.
The heartbreaking reality is that you'll find a lot of the same thing happening 4,000 miles to the south.
And what is going to happen to these people here?
Well, that's an interesting question from a policy and a law perspective. The choices are you either have to adapt to them in some way, adjust to them, or eventually you have to retreat.
Environmental law professor Rob Virchik flies with Tegan Wendland, the news director at public radio station WWNO, over Bayou Du Large, one of the farthest points south in Louisiana.
It's sad. This water has really opened up in some places.
And while it's sad from the air, it's tragic down on the ground.
The water's so close to us now, it just... it takes nothing for it to get here. It's on your doorstep right now.
Mackie Lacoste is a Louisiana shrimp boat captain. Where Rob and Tegan were flying, Mackie lives down there.
Every time the south wind blows, any amount of time, you get water in your yards.
Flooding has gotten so bad that the state of Louisiana is at a loss for what to do. They have a plan to move people, but there's no money to do it. People like Mackie's neighbor, Ollie Williams, are at a loss too.
I'm fed up with it. I'm disgusted. I hate coming home. It's depressing hearing airboats. It's depressing mosquitoes. It's sad when you just can't go outside and play with your kids.
My husband's disabled. We get $1,000 a month to live. How would we pay off our mortgage to be able to buy a home somewhere else to relocate? It's impossible. There's no way.
We've always loved the place.
It's kind of bittersweet. It's like, in a way, it almost like my husband says, like they're pushing us out of here. That's how I feel. And to have all our family grown up here, it's kind of sad that my kids won't be able to grow up how I did out here.
Stores are pulling out too. They know the risk. The only store left, the only one, is 18 miles away. And for shrimpers like Mackie, the exodus has made it nearly impossible to do their work every day.
You snap your fingers and have 20 people at your house to help you do something. Now there's no one.
The problems we've been hearing are huge, and they are happening all over the world. We may not have many answers yet, but we're working on it. When we come back, we take you to the top of the world to talk with people who are working to figure out the future course of the Arctic and how to prepare and respond to what they find. This is Listening to the Arctic from the National Science Foundation. Stay with us. This is Listening to the Arctic from the National Science Foundation. A decade ago, scientists found something about the Arctic that was shocking.
The sea ice has been disappearing faster than our best models were predicting.
Marika Holland is with the Earth Systems Lab at the National Center for Atmospheric Research in Colorado. Models like that are critical. They tell scientists and policymakers what to expect. And she says because of this discovery, they realized
there are processes at work that we're missing in the models, and we still don't fully understand these things.
This, she said, made everyone redouble their efforts.
We need to work with observationalists who are going out into the field to understand processes and then feed that information back into the models to continually make them better.
When you hear those statistics that tell you that the oceans are warming or the glaciers are melting or it's hotter, it's colder, and you wonder, where do those numbers come from? This is where. from scientists measuring precisely what's happening up there and what it could mean for all of us.
Okay, ready there, Captain? Mark?
Imagine standing at the top of the world, and when you're there, doing something no scientist, in fact, no other human, has ever done.
30 seconds.
Tell me when I have 10.
And imagine standing by the ocean at the top of the world and then diving in.
Have fun down there, Ken.
Oh, yeah.
For Ken Dunton, he's the underwater weather forecaster we introduced you to earlier, it's all in a day's work.
And that's what's fantastic about being on the Arctic coast in the summertime is that sun just goes round and round, and you have near sunsets and near sunrises at 2 o'clock in the morning. It's just fantastic.
When we talk about scientists working to understand and forecast environmental change, figure out precisely just what's going on in the Arctic, Ken and his team at the Beaufort Lagoon Long-Term Ecological Research Station, the Beaufort LTER, are at the cutting edge.
This is the furthest north of all the LTERs in the country.
How's the visibility look, Christina?
Good. It looks real good.
That's what I want to hear.
They're working today on Stevenson Sound in the northernmost part of Alaska. Ken works on estuary lagoons, bodies of water that are responsible for some of the world's most abundant fisheries.
Estuaries are the meeting place between the marine and terrestrial environment.
They work the same way all over the world. They're mixing zones where stuff from the land washes into the water, breaks down, and makes the abundance of life in the ocean possible.
Whether I'm talking about finfish or shellfish, crabs, lobsters, shrimp.
But while lagoons are well studied and understood, Ken works on Arctic lagoons. There's practically nothing, almost no research on what's going on there. And as the climate changes, Ken's work becomes vital because those lagoons are absolutely central to the Arctic food chain, top to bottom, the top being us.
Can I start the engine?
Yes.
What's happening to the soft coral, the snails, and the worms? Is there enough to feed the seals, birds, and fish, which are in turn eaten by humans? As it gets warmer, there's another open question he's exploring. These days, dirt that's been frozen for thousands of years is melting, and it's washing into the lagoons, making them murky. Is everything still getting enough light?
Pick a spot.
And there's another open question. As the sea ice melts, the ocean waves get higher. That means dirt and leaves and bugs and other things that have never entered the water before are washing into the lagoons before they're broken down. Are they digestible?
It's like, go ahead and have a piece of bark for dinner off this tree. See what that does for you.
Ken and his team are up there examining it, in some cases for the first time ever.
What is going on during the period of ice cover? What is the food source? Are these guys, are they all starving? What's going on? And what's happening in the summertime?
They try and figure all this out through the painstaking deployment of instruments.
You have to pull it out that way.
What is the weather underneath the surface of the ice or underneath the surface of the water in these lagoons?
30 centimeters.
Down,
drop, down, 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 down. Okay, down. Good. No, that's good.
We drop the instrument slowly onto the seabed.
Ready?
I'm ready.
Mark.
And then we get to the end of it and we say mark again and the waypoint is recorded.
All right, that waypoint is 231.
231.
To measure light, temperature, salinity, pH, water speeds or currents, and circulation.
Okay, good deal.
2016 is a line going to 231.
Sea ice can grab a device in the winter and pull it hundreds of miles away. To make sure that doesn't happen, all these instruments have to be screwed in tight. That means sometimes they have to deploy their meters by hand. Jumping into 0 degree water.
Diving in the Arctic at temperatures of freezing and below is quite a bit different than diving warm tropical waters. I've done both. In the Arctic, it takes thousands of dollars worth of gear, dry suits, undergarments, gloves, and booties, and the whole nine yards. It takes a good 30 to 45 minutes to get a diver properly attired and into the water.
And they can be down there for a good long time.
We dive all day long. We're in these dry suits for 10 to 12 hours. And by the end of that period, we are exhausted and just plain hypothermic.
Even weighed down with gear and instruments, crawling through the murky, frigid water, Ken and his team know how important each sensor they place, each measurement they take, some of which are the first ever taken by humans, how important all this will be to our understanding of the Arctic's present and its future, and its global impact. And it turns out the present and future are not the only part of the answer. Because sometimes, in order to understand and forecast environmental change, you need to look not at the present, but at the past.
The sound of walking on a glacier.
As humans have done on and off since the 26th century BC, Jason Briner of the New York State University at Buffalo trudges across the Greenland ice sheet. Something that's surprisingly easy to do once you're up there, considering that the ice sheet covers three-quarters of the island.
Drop it. You know, you can just leave it.
We want to unwrap it, though.
Okay.
Briner and his team are not explorers, and they're not tourists.
We're a bunch of geologists that are, for this project, considering the Earth's past.
Looking at the past to try and understand the present and maybe predict the future.
The light is low in the sky, and just above the ice sheet surface, the skyline is a cloud bank that's starting to glow a little bit pink. The skyline is filled by the Greenland ice sheet. It's white and it's brown because there's dirt in it. In some places, the skyline is smooth. In other places, it's very rugged and rough because it's crevassed. Where
a lot of observational work in the Arctic is designed to tell us what's happening right now. That's critical because it's changing quickly, but right now is not the only time frame that matters.
And there was a time period several thousand years ago when the Arctic was maybe as warm as today.
And that's what they're trying to find out. What happened the last time? Because it might just be the case that as the Arctic heats up, it might actually slow the rate of ice sheet melting just a touch.
Do you think it's worthwhile running the piston cable up through here just to keep them in line?
See, as the Arctic gets warmer, it also gets wetter. Some of that new moisture might come down as snow. That, in turn, might mean the ice sheet won't shrink as fast. If that happens, that's important to the rest of us.
No one really knows the rate of how quickly the ice sheet's going to melt, and therefore how fast sea level is going to rise.
But there might be clues from 1,000 years ago.
Put this right there for now. I'm going to put the hammer right there.
Okay.
So this is the part where we bring in geology.
What Briner and his team do is travel across Greenland, largely collecting rocks. Some they chip, some they hack off with a saw.
And we put these samples in baggies and bring them home to the lab and do some isotopic analyses on them.
There are various geological techniques that can tell them, was the area warmer or colder in the past? Was it wetter or drier? That can tell us where the glacier was in the past and when it was there.
Because I think, for example, I might come back in the boat because it helps to have, I could step on that step and pull back that way.
They're also trying to understand whether it was bigger or smaller than today. To do that,
we get in boats, and from those boats, we suspend via cable core tubes, empty tubes, to the bottom of the lake, and we pound those vertically into the mud at the bottom of the lake. We pull them back to the surface. We bring them back to our labs and split them open. Within those mud tubes are a series of layers that tell us time in the past.
Using a variety of computer simulations, they compare that evidence about how the glacier changed with evidence about how the climate changed. By doing that,
we have a better quantitative understanding of what causes the ice sheet to change. What are the specific climate variables that force it to grow or force it to shrink, and what are the rates of those processes?
All this new work in the Arctic has created new needs. For example, Jason Briner moves around Greenland the same way people have always done in the Arctic, by foot and dog sled. And just like it's always been, that can be exhausting, time-consuming, and dangerous. But just as new advances in remote sensing and data management are changing Arctic research, there's also a revolution in how scientists get from place to place.
Right. And in my lab, we'll find three of my robots dating back starting 2005. And
Dr. Laura Ray is part of that revolution. She's dean of the School of Engineering at Dartmouth.
The primary way a robot would help is that it takes human labor out of the picture.
Radio communication established.
So then in camp, we would take joystick control.
Joystick enabled.
And then we can start driving it forward.
That's one of her grad students, Austin Lines, working with Frosty Boy, which he helped design. A 1 meter by 1 meter box with skeletonized aluminum wheels, just structure with nothing in the middle. Frosty Boy is the third generation of robots that are allowing scientists to continuously monitor regions like the Arctic in real time and go where researchers can't.
Is this an important log file?
Frosty Boy and his ancestors have been hauling instruments across the Antarctic in the south and in Greenland in the north for the past 12 years. They've learned a lot over that time, maybe most important about the difference between snow at the top and bottom of the world. In the Antarctic, the snow is firm. It's like driving on a road. But the Arctic is very dry, and deep snow can be like a swamp.
Almost like quicksand.
And for Dr. Ray's team, that is always front of mind.
We're starting from the terrain up. What does the terrain demand? And then how can we optimize the design of the robot to minimize the potential to get stuck?
In doing that, Dr. Ray's lab, which, remember, is in central New Hampshire, likely has an advantage over some other robot labs in the country.
If you've never driven in snow, you don't know how to drive in snow.
They know snow in New Hampshire.
When you walk in snow, you sink, and if you put on snowshoes, you don't sink as much, because the snowshoes spread that force over a larger area. So it's the same with a robot.
Usually the way you do that with a robot is to give it tracks. But a track vehicle consumes more energy than a wheeled vehicle. Up in the Arctic, you might not have access to the energy you need. Dr. Ray's team has kept their robots lightweight. The other advantage there is they're less likely to sink. They've also done away with the expensive cameras that some robot developers have used for navigation. After all, in the Arctic,
there's nothing to look at. I mean, it's just white.
And they've taught their robots that seat-of-the-pants feeling a New Englander gets when you're slipping on the ice.
The wheels start slipping. And if you can catch that, you say, aha, this is likely preceding me about to get stuck.
Slipping on the ice is, of course, common in a place where temperatures will get down to 20 or even 50 below Fahrenheit. And that's not the only problem ice can create for scientists and the increasing array of others who are heading up to the Arctic for research and business. Ship decks freeze up, solar panels ice over, turbines seize up. For scientists like plant biologist Sindonia Brethart at Alaska's Tulik Lake Field Station, it's an every year problem.
There are periods where we lose data during the winter if something goes wrong.
As for what to do, there's a couple of scientists who think the answer might be in physics.
I'm going to show three models on the computer right now.
This is Dr. Leming Zhang at Iowa State University. For most of the past 10 years, he and a partner, Dr. Hu Hui, have been focused on the best way to get ice off airplane wings.
And today we are facing right now is called Iowa State's Icing Research Tunnel.
That's Dr. Hui, standing inside the massive room on campus that houses Iowa State's wind tunnel.
In this tunnel, in addition to control the airspeed, we also control the air temperature inside the tunnel.
To do that, they crank up this massive compressor.
It's so noisy, I cannot hear anything from you other than the background noise.
And okay. Drop the temperature down to 13 below Fahrenheit. Then they spray water droplets to watch when, why, and how ice forms and falls off. Recently, though, all the attention to the Arctic has caused them to shift. As Dr. Hui says,
what happened at the surface of the aircraft wing is the same as at the surface of the power line of marine vessels, even the offshore oil platform near the Arctic environment.
Their new focus today is on the physics of how ice cracks, which it turns out it does principally in two ways, adhesive cracking and cohesive cracking. The team at Iowa State is working to figure out the difference. In other words, what makes the ice break apart and what makes the ice fall away. believe it or not, this is something that's not well understood.
We're seeing a movie, and that movie is showing how water droplet is becoming ice.
The simulations in Dr. Zhang's lab demonstrate the problem. In trying to do the math to create the simulations,
you can consider every material as a collection of atoms, including ice and metallic surfaces.
Modelers in the past would put all those atoms together. If you do that, though, the degree of freedom involved in the simulation
will be huge.
Too big to look at the problem at the scale that's most likely to give you answers.
We want to go beyond nanoscale.
Let's say you have instruments that sit outside all winter in the Arctic.
Things like our towers, they're just out there, and so the instruments just have to be able to hack it at that temperature, and sometimes they don't work.
If they try to chop off the ice, they can break the instrument. Spray on ice-phobic coating, it might not work at 50 below. The idea behind the work at Iowa State is to figure out the precise calculations that will allow them to create computer simulations that have just enough detail, but not too much. That way, Dr. Zhang says,
before they test any devices, they can build a model using our software and test how the material surfaces or the instrument will respond and how the de-icing will happen and how to avoid it using computers.
Researchers are taking advantage of technical advances like these to rush to the Arctic in ever greater numbers. As they do, and as scientific agencies around the world have begun to analyze the numbers they sent back, it's blowing some holes in long-held assumptions about the region. Because of where the Arctic is on the map, there's been a common hypothesis that conditions up there are pretty much the same from place to place. Lately, we're finding out, though, that that's not actually true.
That makes it difficult to generalize about what's happening in the Arctic.
Laura Goff at Towson University in Maryland has spent countless summers in Alaska.
The weather across the Arctic in any given year is not consistent.
The variations can be enormous. Where Jason Briner sees this in Greenland.
We've had really glorious, long dry spells, lots of sunny skies.
2,000 miles to the west, on nearly the same latitude in northern Alaska, there are sea ice levels that Ken Dunton hasn't seen in decades.
Lots of ice, very little open water, not much in the way of waves, much colder.
At the same time, 130 miles south at Tulik Lake, biologist Sindonia Brett Hart says,
it's probably about 55 degrees Fahrenheit, which is pretty warm for the Arctic.
This broad variation has inspired a push. Laura Goff says scientists need to figure out why do some regions respond in one way while others don't.
And so we have different efforts underway, some of which are U.S. funded and some of which are internationally funded, to make those measurements.
This is where we deploy our fishnets, and we're going to be doing a plankton net pretty soon.
This is part of one of those efforts. Dr. Karen Ashton walks across the deck of the research vessel RV Sikulyak in the Beaufort Sea off Nome, Alaska.
And this is a room from where we launched the CTD and Rosette. And a CTD is a core instrument for...
Karen's a biologist with the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute. The work she's doing is a small part of a huge and innovative observation project called the Distributed Biological Observatory. It's a series of tightly delineated lines that run for hundreds of miles north to south across the Bering and Chukchi Seas, locations that are biologically important in U.S. territorial waters, collecting data on the animals that serve as food for whales, seals, and birds.
Specifically, we're looking for the food chain that starts with the plankton, the larger...
The observatory is trying to figure out the impact of warmer water and new volumes of fresh water on this vital food source. While they do use satellites, the most important tool the observatory has are scientists like Karen Ashton, who is in Alaska to see and measure things with her own eyes.
Well, there really isn't any other way to do it. You can't sense zooplankton remotely.
U.S. and international science and management agencies are gathering massive amounts of data, making it available to everyone, scientists and the public, and making sure it's useful information that helps show what's happening in the Arctic, and what they find will be critical to helping us navigate this extreme environment and may even lead to whole new fields of scientific study. They'll also help bring together researchers from a wide swath of fields and disciplines. More on that when we come back. This is Listening to the Arctic from the National Science Foundation. This is Listening to the Arctic from the National Science Foundation. You heard about scientists all working in their small teams in isolation, but though they may never meet, in a sense, they're all banded together in a larger scientific team. That's the only way to get a problem this big solved and to get it done right. Here's Arctic biologist Laura Goff from Towson University in Maryland.
In order to understand the way that this system is behaving as an entire system, requires scientists who work in particular areas to talk to each other and cross subdisciplinary areas.
And just like a lot of the science you've heard about in this program, this approach is a big idea too. Finding ways to gather different branches of science and engineering and get them to pool their knowledge, their methods, and their expertise. That's been found to work better for solving large societal problems. Under the old paradigm, as University of Arizona environmental policy professor Stephanie Rainey puts it,
we're all sitting in different corners of the sandbox building our part of the project.
So someone's over there testing the water, someone else is studying the ecosystem's biology, someone else is looking at human health, everyone else is building their own sandcastle, and
maybe you share a tool every once in a while.
To build a truly successful solution, though, you need the geologists, biologists, or economists to be making observations and collecting data so that, say, engineers dealing with day-to-day challenges on the ground can plan effectively for the future. Engineers like Billy Connor, who's director of the Alaska University Transportation Center in Fairbanks.
There are a lot of things that are going on here that we don't really understand. We're trying to understand them, and we're hoping, we are now working with our climatologists to try to understand what their predictions are and try to educate them as to what our needs are.
All of this interdisciplinary integration can't come soon enough.
This ship is made to first cut the ice and then kind of lift the weight of the ship onto the ice and just continuously break it.
This is the captain of a ship called the Umiak, owned by the Chinese shipping giant COSCO. It's part of a groundbreaking change. The second ship ever to travel the Arctic Ocean through Canada without an icebreaker escort. The captain is speaking in a news story from the International Service of China Central Television.
Some have even labeled the Northwest Passage Panama Canal North, meaning container ships, cruise ships, and other vessels are finding the icy water more appealing to trim time and money off their trips.
In addition to tourism and faster shipping, oil, gas, and mineral resources in the Arctic are now potentially easier to access, and that's creating new opportunities and challenges for engineers and planners looking to build infrastructure up north. One place they're looking for help with those challenges is something called Decision, Risk, and Management Science, or DRMS. It's science that's crucial in an emergency, though where you really need it is earlier than that.
Hello, Kodiak. Sergeant Beaver here. Just want to again remind everybody, this is not a drill. This is an actual tsunami warning.
DRMS helps communities think ahead about things like, when do you tell people to evacuate, or where do you build things so it might not have to happen?
Pillar Mountain is safe. However, it is very backed up right now, so you won't make it there in 5 minutes. So best place right now is a high school parking lot.
It relies on people like sociologists or psychologists who examine behavior on how we form biases or the role fear plays in decision making. And it relies on others. Political scientist Tom Berkland from North Carolina State University is one of them.
Economists in particular and psychologists are studying how you can structure problems that cause people to make better decisions based on better information.
Everybody get out of your homes and make it the safe place.
100 feet.
100 feet, at least 100 feet or higher.
Some of this is more obvious. For example, looking at risk, an easy one in the Arctic might be,
what is the risk to the object you're building?
Maybe a town wants to build an airport to last 100 years, but it's on eroding land that might only last 20 years. For policymakers to decide, they need more than just numbers.
We can't just say, this is the risk. People have different perceptions of different risks. We need to understand how that shapes the decisions they make. We need to know what their decision-making timeline is, whether they're thinking about next year, 5 years, 50 years.
Scientists will create sets of data that look at maybe how the community has traditionally made decisions or how trust is created there. The data is put into models to help things run more smoothly. As a practical example, Tom Berkland's with a group that's trying to
develop models to figure out where to put emergency response equipment in the Arctic.
Maybe Nome, Alaska is getting more cruise ships. Ships have medical emergencies, so Nome wants to build a warehouse to store medicines. Seems positive on the surface, but collecting data can help the community figure out
would it actually create more problems, such as having to guard it to make sure that there's no theft? If you put prescription drugs in one of these stockpiles, does that become a security risk for the community?
Tom Berkland says looking at these problems ahead of time and in a systematic way can be indispensable.
These are socio-political processes that oftentimes require discussion, compromise, things like that, to make a decision, because there's no magic answer to a lot of these questions.
To aid in that planning, some things are key. One is data. And as you heard, there are teams of scientists gathering it and others pulling it in to analyze and give advice. But you need more than that. Robert Ortung is a professor of international affairs at George Washington University who specializes in sustainability in Arctic cities.
You need to have an understanding of how the humans are going to interact with those solutions, what's going to motivate their behavior to behave in ways that are helping to promote a solution to these problems.
That's important. He says that too often people planning and designing approaches to complex problems forget that
there's clearly a strong interaction between the social, the natural, and the built environment.
The built environment, that's the buildings and the infrastructure that we put in the natural environment.
The social aspect is how people actually use those buildings, how they interact with the built environment and the natural environment.
We're seeing collaborative work being done by engineers and social scientists. Engineers would like to understand how their systems interact with people. Social scientists would like to show engineers that there are these interactions.
It's an approach that's worked elsewhere, according to Robin Alden, who spent 40 years as an environmental policymaker in Maine.
As we approach this opening up to humans of the Arctic, we need to be including many different types of knowledge in the pursuit of making smart decisions.
We need to have multidisciplinary research to address the big and complicated questions, because you need to bring in all the different perspectives.
What you can do as scientists, if you're working across disciplines, is you come together and you work to answer community questions. That's part of the key. If a community is leading the inquiry and has questions, it's easier to see how your different knowledges fit into the answer to those questions.
That includes the knowledge of the peoples who have lived in the Arctic for thousands of years. Here's anthropologist Anna Kartula.
Scientists have understood that indigenous people in the Arctic have knowledge that could be very useful to them.
And in some cases, that's meant working with Alaskan natives to tap into local knowledge.
There's more grasses growing on sandbars that didn't used to have it. There's sandbars that have tons of little willows growing on them now. And I don't know what all that adds up to, but it's definitely a big change.
But it's also about coming to understand that lots of scientists who don't live in the Arctic only come there when the weather is warm. The people who live there are around more and see things.
The fish have definitely changed in the sense that they seem to be coming earlier and then they go weeks and weeks later into the end of the season.
That's invisible to the shore-based person.
Most of the questions that I ask now are derived from conversations with communities and their unique perspectives that they have on change on the land.
Todd Brinkman is a professor of wildlife ecology at the University of Alaska Fairbanks.
Working with communities, they beat me to good questions all the time.
It's something that Robin Alden saw too when she worked to manage the lobster population for the governor of Maine.
When I was commissioner in the 90s, fishermen would say, "We have breeding lobsters in deep water." And the scientists would say, "You're wrong."
That's largely because the scientists didn't know where to look, according to Kristen Porter, who is president of the Maine Lobstermen's Association.
They were only looking in the shallow waters and predicting doom and gloom, but the lobsters kept showing up.
The scientific understanding about these animals may be overly simplistic based on what the scientists have been able to observe in their limited time on the water.
And lo and behold, when they sampled those waters, they found lobsters deeper than when they thought. So
what they learned here is important to keep in mind.
The things we've learned in New England about involving fishermen in good science and good policy applies directly to the Arctic. The only way we're going to be able to be wise about the way we use that area is to create governance informed by scientific and indigenous observation on a real-time basis.
That includes everyone talking and listening, people with indigenous knowledge talking to the broader scientific community, and both groups working with decision makers.
The knowledge of fishermen, the knowledge of people who have lived in one place for generations, it's essential to include that type of knowledge in the pursuit of good science and then smart policy.
Because scientists can't solve all the problems by themselves. But what they learn can inform in every realm, technical, economic, social, political, from local to international. The key is making sure that all voices are included. Here again is the University of Arizona's Stephanie Rainey.
If we can get away from the fact that we are in a system that only utilizes one knowledge as the primary knowledge and move towards accessing all of the different knowledge systems, we will have more of an opportunity to address some of our needs and aspirations in our communities.
One of the best ways to do that, she says,
is supporting Indigenous scholars.
That's something Dr. Rainey's own family has done. In 1995, her parents started a scholarship program for Alaskan Native students at MIT. And that same year, another program started. Realizing that if Alaska Native kids were going to get to the door of MIT or any other college, those kids were going to have to do a lot of work.
Waka, Kuyana Dialuchi, we Michael Edmund Kidu Ralga Ulranoga, Chivar Miungunga, Chupikto. Hello, and thank you all for coming. My name is Michael Edmund Kidu Ralga Ulran, and I am a Chupik Eskimo.
Michael Ulran is from Chivak, Alaska, a native village of 938 people on the Bering Sea. When you hear it said about Alaska Natives that
they need their own scientists to work on the problems with their communities,
young people like Michael are who they're talking about.
Today, after 8 years of pursuing my educational goal, I've become the first engineer in the history of my village.
This was the commencement ceremony at the University of Alaska Anchorage in 2014, where Michael spoke as the representative of ANSEP, the university's Alaska Native Science and Engineering Program. Herb Schroeder is ANSEP's founder.
Native science, as people refer to this, is really no different than Western science. The only difference is that Native people have been doing it for 10,000 years.
When Herb started ANSEP in 1995, it didn't take long to learn that for students who come to campus from rural Alaska, the academic challenges of college are only half the battle. Rural Alaska villages can be uncommonly remote and tiny.
Some communities are 100, some communities are a couple thousand. Sometimes students show up at the university and the number of people in their dormitory is actually greater than the number of people in their village.
In college, the speed of life is intense.
Everything is so totally new.
The cultural values can be unfamiliar, and absorbing all of that can make it hard to learn.
The cognitive load ends up so high that they can't focus on being successful academically.
So ANSEP starts out early.
We start working with kids in fifth grade.
Okay, so during your research, keep that in mind.
In middle school, it's all hands-on science and engineering projects.
We built the computer.
We give them problems they don't think they can solve.
I never thought I'd build a computer in my life until I came here.
We give them all the parts for a computer and they assemble that.
It looked really hard, but it was pretty simple. You just have to pay attention.
And they can remain in the program all the way to a PhD.
We started to grow our own PhD program. And we have two of those early students who graduated, and each of them are the only Alaska Native PhDs in their fields in the world.
Their plan is to grow a brand new cadre of Arctic-focused Alaska Native engineers and scientists.
Indigenous scholars who go and obtain Western science knowledge degrees and can come back to community and use those multiple ways of knowing to answer questions.
That's the goal. And as Michael Ulran put it back at UA graduation,
repeat after me. Nothing can stop me from reaching my goals.
I have a lot of faith in Arctic peoples.
Anthropologist Anna Kurtula.
Inuit, Yupik, Chukchi, Greenlanders, they've been in that space for thousands of years. And I think if we listen more to them and we have a better understanding of what they know about the Arctic, I have faith and optimism that if we do that, that we may indeed be able to find a solution or at least an adaptation to what's happening in the world.
We have to become respectful of multiple scales of observation, and we have to become adaptive in how we respond to the changes in the environment.
Maine fisheries advocate Robin Alden.
You can't assume complexity away. All you can do is continue to learn in a changing environment.
And because of that complexity, it's going to require an all-hands-on-deck approach, sharing insights and ideas. This is the kind of environment that nurtures cooperation, and it's that kind of cooperation that solves great challenges. Scientists are realizing the new and complex questions that can be answered when we work in close partnership. Indeed, we are all navigating our new Arctic together. As political scientist Robert Artung says,
we've been very good at developing our specific disciplines. Now it's time to try and bring together some of those very specific responses to specific problems and focus on this much bigger global issue of promoting sustainability.
It's work being taken on by hundreds of researchers, indigenous groups, dozens of nations, all of whom know that it's only by bringing together technology, science, people, and policy that we will meet the challenges, investigate the great mysteries, and reveal the immense opportunities of this new and rapidly changing Arctic. Listening to the Arctic was written and produced by Richard Paul. We'd like to thank Christina Boncel and Kathy D'Antonio. We had technical help from Kara Gillen, Jim Blackwood, Alex Donaldson, Daniela Alley, Jay Field, Eamon Swenson, and Caroline Lasnik. And we want to extend a special thanks to Phil Loring and Sarah Betcher at Farthest North Films and Sustainable Futures North, who provided audio of Alaska Native people. Original music was composed and arranged by Lenny Williams. This program comes to you from R.L. Paul Productions and the National Science Foundation, supporting early stage research in all fields of science and engineering, from the Earth's poles to black holes. I'm Richard Paul.